Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, screenwriting software with over 100 templates that format and paginate screenplays, teleplays, and stage plays. More information at finaldraft.com. Today, on Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast, original Ghostbuster Harold Ramis.
I've actually had friends call me and say my five-year-old is having a problem sleeping because he's afraid we have a ghost. So I actually have gotten on the phone with kids and said, listen, I am a Ghostbuster. I have checked out your whole neighborhood. There are no ghosts in your neighborhood.
The brand new reboot of the supernatural comedy classic Ghostbusters hits theaters July 15th. Ghostbusters is co-written and directed by Paul Feig and stars Melissa McCarthy, Kristen Wiig, Kate McKinnon, and Leslie Jones as the title characters. The original 1984 Ghostbusters was directed by Ivan Reitman and stars Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Sigourney Weaver, Rick Moranis, Ernie Hudson, and Harold Ramis, who co-wrote the film with Dan Aykroyd. Harold Ramis passed away in 2014, and his film legacy is an important part of the American comedic vocabulary, from Animal House to National Lampoon's Vacation to Groundhog Day and, of course, Ghostbusters. Comedy impresario Judd Apatow spoke with Harold Ramis at the 12th Austin Film Festival in 2005, where we also held a special screening of Ramis's thriller comedy, The Ice Harvest.
Well, when you watch yourself over the years, I just obsess on how did I pick those glasses? You know, but I remember what I weighed in each movie. You know. So.
Now, do you remember that I interviewed you when I was in high school? Yes.
How did that happen?
Well,
what high school?
Syosset High School on Long Island. All the alums are here, and there's maybe 83. So what, you were doing Vacation around this time?
83, we would have... Vacation came out, so we'd probably just shot it.
Now, I had the audio tape of that, but I spared you. Mainly, I spared myself, because it's really me, like, going, so how did you write Stripes?
Well, let me just say that a comedy nerd is an oxymoron. We're all nerds deep down.
Yes. You were very nice, because usually when I would walk in, there would be shock and alarm. And you.
But well, which would indicate just, you know, how much I had to do.
Anyway, you know, I thought about preparing for today and then just decided that's not right. I'll just go with the moment.
Yeah, he's really prepared because he emailed me and said, what should I ask you?
Was everyone here at the Ice Harvest last night?
Yeah.
So I got to be careful. I don't want to repeat your Ice Harvest Q&A. All my questions about it, I assume, were asked last night, such as, is that a direction that you feel like you want to go to in the future in terms of not necessarily straight out comedic movies?
We were both at Deauville, France. We both had our films in consecutive nights at the Festival du Cinéma Américain, which means that it's a festival the studios basically pay for to show their movies in Europe.
I thought I went because my film was important.
Yeah, well, that's all right. It's a publicity event for American movies. But someone asked me there, they said, you know, did I want to make this movie because I was anticipating a trend, you know? And I said, yeah, I kind of sensed that that there was going to be a big market for existential retro film noir, you know? To get to your question, I only look at my career in retrospect. Like, I've never been able to anticipate what I should do next from a career point of view other than to say, you know, I should make a really good film. If you go by what's current in the marketplace from a career point of view, you're already a year too late because stuff that's come out and is popular now is, you know, someone thought of that 2 years ago just to get it in the pipeline. And to think 2 years in advance, what are people going to like 2 years from now? You know, it's impossible to anticipate the 9/11s and the Hurricane Katrinas and, you know, the end of the Republican domination of American politics. You know, if we knew that stuff with any certainty, we could, you know, I could know that I should make, you know, a Shark from Outer Space movie. In 2 years, it would be popular, right? So all I have to go on is what I like, and this amazing script comes across my desk, and coincidentally, I had just read all of Richard Russo's novels, all of them. lo and behold, Richard Russo, Robert Benton script, you know. And I read it, you know, and it was great. And I thought, wow. Reading that one, just on the page, I could see the movie, and it was a movie I wanted to see. And you know, we get hundreds, literally hundreds of scripts.
But you read all of them cover to cover?
I do read them all, yes. I feel obligated to the writer to read every word of the title page. No, I can honestly say I read every word of the first page of the coverage.
Yes.
If I really like the first page of the coverage, I read the second page of the coverage. And then I call my agent and say, how is the script? I've said this to young writers, you know, the sad reality is, you know, people tell you that, you know, that the first 10 pages have to really grab somebody, but I'm telling you, it's the first page, first 2 pages, you know. If I see a typo in the first paragraph, I'm done.
Don't read my scripts. Because as a result of spell check, I literally don't know how to spell in life now.
Well, I'm doing the New York Times crossword puzzle.
Yeah. Now, that's what I hear, is that you're like obsessed with crossword puzzles, and as you direct, you're actually doing the New York Times crossword puzzle?
Yeah, which might be a little unsettling to the person who's asking me a question, but it's a kind of multitasking. It's also a way, it might be a way of relieving anxiety. I kind of live in a landscape of words and letters, and, you know, they take on, it's almost like meditative. So I need to do the New York Times puzzle every day. I need to. And even if I'm in the middle of the set, I'm doing the puzzle, and, you know, people ask you things. I stop for a moment.
That's so the opposite of me in every way. Every time I'm writing, I think, I don't know a lot of words.
One of my favorite desk references that I keep near me is a book called What's What? Do any of you know What's What? It's a glossary of descriptive terms of parts of a chair, parts of a microphone, parts of a wall, parts, you know, and it has the exact word. In some script, there was a runaway subway train. And you get to that point, you're writing, and you say the driver of the subway lets go of that thing that makes the train go forward, you know. So you grab what's what and what's that called, you know. And this is amazing. The picture cards in a deck of cards all have names. The kings all have a different name. The queens and jacks all have different names. And it's in that book, What's What. I love that book.
You know, when you look back, not in terms of quality, but in terms of just a good time, what is the movie you think of? Like, that's the one that we had the great time making.
The good time movie for me has been every single one of them without exception. And I don't say that as a kind of Pollyanna, because there have been nightmarish situations. And maybe it's a little key into my interest in the ice harvest. I thrive on disaster. I'm very excited when things go wrong. I'm really attracted to outlandish and excessive human behavior. Any experience with Bill Murray is better than any other experience because he does things no one you know would ever do. Every ride with Bill is a potential adventure. And I say this with love and considerable distance because I don't talk to him and I don't see him, but the memories of doing those films with him, or even doing a film like Vacation, which, you know, when I design productions, you know, it's kind of the best of all possible worlds for a social person, which I am. Because you assemble everyone you like. If you're lucky, you pick a beautiful place to make the movie or a real interesting place. And then you're with them for, like, months, you know, with nothing else to do but focus on the work. And it's like an excuse, you know, can't drive the kids to school.
So, my wife is so on to that.
Yeah.
She considers all work play. So if I'm not working and I say, I'd like to go to the movies with my friend, she's like, you hang out with your friends all day long.
That's right. I had the same thing with my first wife.
Your first wife? Yeah. What was the first movie that you directed?
First movie I directed was Caddyshack.
Yeah.
We were already kind of corrupted by the initial success of Animal House, which we'd written. And I had been in... I had been professionalized for 10 years before Animal House. I'd been, you know, paid for writing and performing from starting in 1968. So 78 was when Animal House came out. So I was already... I could always support myself. I was through the job struggle period. Things were happening just as I thought they should. You know, I went from improv comedy on the stage to doing, you know, television stuff. And then treatment for Animal House, movie gets bought, movie gets made, huge hit. Producers literally waiting outside this industry screenings of Animal House to meet me and Doug Kenny and Chris Miller. What do you guys want to do next? It's like a dream, right? Yeah. So I said, well, I want to direct the next thing I write. And John Peters, the producer, best known as the hairdresser who married Barbara Streisand, but a fine producer in his own right, looked at me and said, well, you look like a director. Because I was wearing a safari jacket at the time.
Did you guys all get money for Animal House, or that was like the first thing and you got screwed, or did you all get rich from it?
Well, we didn't get rich. Well, I got $2,500 for the treatment, and Chris, Doug, and I split $30,000 for the screenplay, 10 apiece, and they slipped me another $2,000 because I did the final polish. But we shared 5 net points of the movie, 1.6 each, and there were no gross players in the film, and the film was relatively low budget. When the movie came out, we did a quick calculation, and we thought, hey, we're going to make some money. I think we made in the, under 500,000 range. But then 78, it seemed like a lot of money. I literally took the review to the bank, home savings in Santa Monica, and bought a house on the review of Animal House.
Yeah. Well, that, for a lot of us, that's the first R-rated movie we saw with our parents. Tell me a little bit about Doug Kenny, who is a legend, and also maybe a little bit about your thoughts on when you have like a group of people that's doing a lot of work together, and as like the years pass by and that group separates, what was that social world like for those funny people?
Having Second City as my first professional experience was great, because Second City, it's so different from stand up. In the world of stand up, you really talk about killing. And it's not just killing the audience, it's killing every other comedian. It's a competition. Every night of stand-up, open, it's you want to be better than everyone else. The whole thrust of Second City is to focus on making everyone else look good. And in that process, we all look good. So it's more than collaborative. Your life on stage depends on the other people and on developing actual techniques for creating cooperative work, right? We have rules, we have guidelines, we have games and techniques to teach that. And it fosters a spirit at Second City that exists to this day. Anyone who's ever worked at Second City can run into any other generation of Second City players, and they instantly share a language and an approach to their work, with a few exceptions. There are some egos that have kind of emerged over the years, but even those people still appreciate what Second City was. The shows are up 6 nights a week, 8 performances a week, so that's a lot of stage experience. It's all material you've written yourself. John Belushi got hired from Second City. We were in a show together. He got hired to go to the National Lampoon, and they did a big Woodstock music festival parody called Lemmings. It was a big breakout show for John. Chevy Chase was discovered in that show, and Christopher Guest. So John was able to write his own ticket at the Lampoon, and Lampoon wanted to do a radio hour, a nationally distributed radio show. They built a studio in the Lampoon building. They let John be the producer, and John brought from Second City me and Gilda Radner and Bill Murray and Brian Murray and Joe Flaherty. So we all moved to New York, and we had this great kind of cohesive Second City spirit. My first day at the Lampoon, we were sent right up to the radio studio, and all the editors of the Lampoon were in the studio doing a musical version of Moby Dick, as if performed at the Little Worth Theater in Sabbath Day Lake, Maine. So it was a regional theater production of this Moby Dick musical, and they'd even put floorboards on the floor of the studio. So when you walked around, it felt like, sounded like you're on the stage. Very thorough, very funny. And we were all given parts, and that's where I met all the editors. So my fantasy was that it was like Second City, that these guys all worked together every day and they sat around. Turned out to be completely wrong. They all hated each other. They were all geniuses, half from Harvard, half from everywhere else. And they were extremely competitive, very vicious. Michael O'Donohue was one of the guys, the most vicious sense of humor ever. And Doug Kenny was the really sweet guy, like a hippie dropout from Harvard who, started the National Lampoon and then took a year off to live in a teepee on Martha's Vineyard. And, he had written a book called Teenage Commies from Outer Space. And he was their kind of resident adolescence and puberty expert. He did the high school yearbook, pretty much. He did first lay comics, first high comics, you know. So we did a stage show for the Lampoon, John Gild and me, Bill, Brian, Joe. We took it on the road, and then we did the radio hour for a while, and then Ivan Reitman saw us perform in Toronto. He wanted to do a movie with the Lampoon. And I said, what about a college movie? I wrote a treatment, blah, blah, blah. So Doug Kenny, they said, who do you want to work with at the Lampoon? And I said, I thought Doug was, like, just the smartest, funniest, nicest guy. So Doug and I teamed up, and then later we brought Chris Miller in. So, but Doug was always, he was really elegant. He wanted to be Cary Grant. He wanted to be Chevy Chase, basically. But he didn't have the performing chops, you know, but he was as smart as could be. Doug used to do a thing. He would stand at my bookcase in my house, and he'd close his eyes, pick a book, just randomly flip to a page, start reading from that page, and at some point start improvising. and you wouldn't know where the book ended and Doug's improv began, you know. And he could do it with any book on the shelf. It was a little parlor trick, you know.
So those weren't the salad days socially for that group. It wasn't like, oh no, the group broke up because...
Not then. You know, Doug's death did a lot. After Animal House was successful, Doug and I continued. We joined with Brian Murray and wrote Caddyshack together. Doug produced it, I directed it, Brian acted in it. We were so arrogant and deluded, we thought Caddyshack would be as big as Animal House. And to have your first movie be what was then like the biggest comedy ever, it kind of sets the bar a little high, you know. And Doug was already troubled, already wrestling with self-esteem issues because of family of origin problems. And substance abuse issues. And so Doug was disappointed. We had a horrific press conference for Caddyshack. It was one of the worst public events I've ever attended, and it was kind of my fault. I said, wouldn't it be great to get Doug Kenny, Chevy, Bill Murray, Rodney Dangerfield, and Ted Knight on the stage to talk to the press? Well, they scheduled it at 9:30 in the morning. None of those four had ever been up at 9:30 in the morning. Doug showed up at the press conference sleepless, hadn't gone to bed the night before. Chevy was rude to the press. Rodney was totally out of it. Bill was crude and off-putting. And the press was hostile. At one point, Doug stands up and tells them all to themselves and then passes out at the table. Chevy concludes his last TV interview of the day with Brian Linehan of Toronto, and Brian Linehan says, Chevy, what would you say, you know, about so and so? And Chevy says, well, what would I say? Could I say f- you, Brian? Could I just say f- you, you know? Just a televised interview. So the next day, someone sends me a clipping that says, if this is the new Hollywood, let's have the old Hollywood back. So Doug was depressed, and I get a call. I don't know why I'm being so self-revealing here, but Doug says, I'm going to Hawaii for 2 weeks to clean up. And I thought, this is a potential disaster. I can't go on this trip. Doug fell from a high place on the island of Kauai, and his body was found a couple days later. And it was, you know, beyond tragic. You know, I'd been in a room with this guy 8 hours a day for, you know, for two movies virtually, you know, like my brother and best friend. And he was, you know, much loved by, you know, a great number of people. And it was sobering, but in a way it was like a Rorschach test. It became a projective device for everyone else in our group. Some thought suicide. Doug was a victim of his own, you know, substance abuse and his own, you know, depression, whatever. Some thought accident. He was careless, you know, it's just fate, existential accident, you know. Others thought murdered by drug dealers on Kauai, you know. There was no evidence for any of it, you know. It was just all about how, you know, I realize it just depends on how you see the world. And, you know, I eventually concluded that Doug died, slipped while looking for a place to jump, you know. That's all I could conclude, you know. And, you know, it's same with John Belushi. John died 2 years later of, you know, an administered overdose. But Isn't that a suicide? When you let a stranger shoot you up with a drug and you don't know what's in the needle. I mean, if you've even gotten to the point of, you know, putting a needle in your body. It's a form of suicide, isn't it? It's a reckless suicide. John Belushi, just a nice segue from Doug Kenny, just to really perk up your morning. John was pulled twice from a burning bed. You know, it happens once, it's kind of a wake-up call. You think, you know, twice, you know, could you start thinking, maybe I have a problem, you know. And that's, you know, that was the miracle of getting clean for me was I have the same problems. I have the same urges and desires and ideas and thoughts. You know, I don't need to be high. Eventually, getting high, I realized just made me sick. You know, I was just sick.
And was it that Ted Knight couldn't stand many of the people on that set? Or
Ted Knight was a little paranoid. If you remember Ted Knight from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, you know, he is that guy to some extent. And Ted saw all this kind of stuff going on around him. And you know, to Ted, Rodney was like the Antichrist. You know, they were generational peers, but Rodney was, you know, all about, you know, partying, nightclubs, you know. Ted was a straight guy who combed his hair 40 times a day, you know. The first thing Chevy ever did was grab Ted around the neck and mess up his hair, you know. So, Ted was like, oh, you know, like, couldn't handle it. My first job out of college, I worked in a locked mental institution for 7 months, and I kind of learned how to deflect insanity, you know, how to deal with it, how to speak to schizophrenics or catatonics or paranoids and suicidal people. You know, and it sounds funny, but it really expanded my my tolerance for extremes of human behavior, which turns out to be great training for working with actors. Because, you know, they start to freak out. They have an incredibly hard job, and most of them are a little bent, even, you know, that's why they're actors in the first place. They have a desperate need to, you know, to get out there and show, reveal something about themselves. Even as a teenager, though, you know, you're in a room full of people, and someone is acting out. God, that's interesting, you know, isn't it? It's always the person who's in big trouble. The rest of the class sits there going, wow, did you hear what he said to the teacher? That was great, you know? We all wish we'd said it, and we're fascinated by the result. He's going to get in trouble. What does that mean, that he's going to be in trouble? Oh, he's not in so much trouble. So, you know, then you meet people like Bill, who says things to people you can't believe he said. And you watch for the, you know, I'm like a sociologist or a psychologist looking for the impact. You know, God, you can say that and get away with it. I've seen Bill, total stranger, comes up to him on the street in New York. Bill, love you on Saturday night. He said, you motherfucker. And he grabs the guy and says, I'm going to bite your nose. And he wrestles him to the ground. Total stranger bites his nose, you know. Well, I guess you can do that.
But what is that? Is he having fun, or is he mad? Or?
Fun for him, I guess, you know.
And does it make it impossible to kind of maintain a relationship with somebody like that?
Well, it keeps you constantly alive to possibility, you know. And anything can happen here.
Yeah.
And there, you know, and it's great. It kind of frees your imagination also to think, well, even as a writer, well, what can happen, you know?
Yeah. How does it feel, you know, to you know, have a, you know, a body of work. In a way, it's almost like being the Beatles. Like, is it kind of boring, like dealing with like the impact of your body of work on people, like how much it means to people, because it's it continues to this day. It's not like you had an Animal House.
Well, you know, grandiosity is the curse of what we do, right? Is thinking, and you know, there's a great kind of rabbinical little motto that says you start each day with a note in each pocket. And one note says, the world was created just for me today. And the other note says, I'm a speck of dust in a meaningless universe. And you have to live, you have to balance both things, you know. I once did a public talk, and I said, you know, I told him that story, and I said, and I literally have a note in each pocket. And I took one out and said, this one says, you're great. And this one says, you're great.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 5 school by USA Today, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. Go to AustinFilmFestival.com now for a special opportunity to save on your conference badge to Austin Film Festival 2016. We've hidden 10 ghosts throughout the AFF website. Find one and save on your purchase. Supply is limited, so go to AustinFilmFestival.com now, bust a ghost, and save. Back to Harold Ramis speaking with Judd Apatow at the 12th Austin Film Festival.
Prior to Belushi's death, Danny had written a couple of scripts that he thought would be good for him and John, all buddy comedies. And Dan had a family history of psychic experience, and, you know, he had people who were mediums and ghost visitations, and he was interested in the paranormal. And Danny wrote an amazingly fanciful, highly technical movie called Ghostbusters, and the assumption was that ghosts were everywhere. There had been a rip in the random mesh of microwave transmission has poked a hole in our reality envelope. And spirits from other worlds were entering our reality. And as a response, professional teams of Ghostbusters, not unlike the Orkin Man, have sprung up as a business and are in the business of ghost elimination and removal. That was the premise. And the script was all over the place and was, you know, had huge kind of problems. And it had no characters, just there were guys who were Ghostbusters and, you know, Danny knew what they looked like, but he's not great on character. So we took that material, and I thought, oh, well, that is a brilliant comic edge. You know, to take the supernatural, something that as audience and in our culture we're conditioned to think of as, woo, you know, and to treat it with the mundanity of exterminators or janitors, you know, that's comedy. That's comedy, you know, lives on these edges. So I thought, well, you can't go wrong with this premise, obviously. And I knew who the characters were right away. I was able to see it. And we actually moved, you know, back in time. And something he hadn't done in his script was to kind of develop where the Ghostbusters came from, who they were before, and how the formation of Ghostbusters, the intrusion of these spirits, the beginning of it. So we went back to the, you know, it was like almost the prequel to what Danny had written. And Danny and I worked on it together. He's a tremendous guy and very generous and lots of fun to be around. And we wrote our draft. And Ivan Reitman, basically he had brought it to Ivan first because Ivan had successfully directed Animal House and at that time Meatballs and Stripes. And Dan's plan was to get Bill Murray and to be the second Ghostbuster. And he had lunch with Ivan and Ivan said, well, let's get Ramis to play the third guy. And we'll get him to write it. That was the thing. So, so they came to see me right. They were at Arts Deli on Ventura Boulevard, and they came to see me right from their lunch. And I read the script and said, "Yeah, let's do this." So, I've actually had friends call me and say, "My 5-year-old is having a problem sleeping because he's afraid we have a ghost." So I actually have gotten on the phone with kids and said, "Listen, I am a Ghostbuster. I have checked out your whole neighborhood. There are no ghosts in your neighborhood." On Halloween, I squeeze into that jumpsuit and I go out with my kids with a flashlight, and I am the Halloween cop. So yeah, it's been a great thing for all of us. Thank you. The premise for Groundhog Day came from, again, an original script by a writer named Danny Rubin, who had this wonderful conception. And Danny's a little kind of a dilettante Buddhist himself, and I read his original script. Again, you know, some big problems in the script, but very convincing in its where it was coming from, and, you know, that despite its flaws, I ended up crying at the end, and I had this feeling like this is kind of a, you know, it's a wonderful life for our time, and I'm a sucker for that Frank Capra stuff. So I thought if it moved me this much, even as, you know, misshapen as the script is at this point, this is definitely a movie. When I first heard the concept, my producer, Trevor Albert, said to me, "You should read the script." I said, "What's it about?" He said, "It's a guy who lives the same day over and over." And I said, "Yeah, it sounds like, you know, high concept stuff. You know, where's that going?" And he said, "No, you got to read it." So I finally read it and saw that it was, you know, had the potential to be much more than its premise. And so I went to work on it, and I got some good advice from one of our kind of development person, Whitney White. Danny's script had begun with Bill already trapped in this time warp, Bill's character, Phil Connors. And Phil Collins, yeah. Whitney said, wouldn't it be interesting to see the beginning of his reaction to getting caught in the time warp instead of starting in the middle? And I said, I don't know. I promised the writer I'd never do that. And she said, well, you can write it. If it doesn't work, you don't have to use it. I said, yeah, that makes sense. So I wrote it, and of course, you know, it seemed important to the movie to show the genesis of the time warp and his initial reactions. And so we shaped that up. I wrote a major rewrite by myself, and then I brought Danny back. And then Bill and I did the final on-our-feet kind of revision. Working with Bill, you just know he's going to come up with so much great stuff that, you know, the last draft of the script is the one that's written on camera, basically. So he's always going to be better than the script. No matter what you've written, no matter how perfect it seems for him, he's going to do better. And you got to leave that door open. So yes, you know, when I worked with Bill, the script was always a suggestion of what we might do, you know. If anything is possible, if I can do anything, then I have there's a limitless capacity to do good. And that's what Groundhog Day is about. Groundhog Day is, you know, Bill destroys all meaning for himself. You know, Buddhism says that our self doesn't even exist. The self is a convenient illusion that gives us ego. And in conventional terms, of course it exists. There's a name and a picture on your driver's license, and you got to get dressed in the morning, you know, and you get someone, your paycheck has to be addressed to somebody. So we have a self, but it's really a set of illusions. You know, I did an exercise in a group once where we were asked to face another person and in 2 minutes describe ourselves. And I started describing myself, and from the very first statement I was thinking, well, that's not really true. That's what I like to think about myself, but, you know, I'm not as good as I'm saying. You know, it's all a projection. So then we switched partners, and they said, now tell this person who you are. So I did a corrective on the first, you know, wrong view of myself, and I started telling this person who I was. And as I'm telling him, I'm thinking, well, that's not me either, you know? We're not who we think we are. We're only occasionally who we want to be, you know? And we're not what other people think we are. So if life is full of possibility and I stop thinking about myself, you end up where Bill ends up in the movie, in the service of others. I called it the Superman complex. You know, by the end of the movie, he's got every moment kind of scheduled where he can do some good. You know, he runs around town catching a kid who falls out of a tree. He's always there to catch the kid. He's always there when the old ladies get the flat tire. We even cut things out where he was always there to put his finger on a package someone was wrapping so they could tie the string. You know, the whole day. And I called it Superman syndrome. How the hell does Superman find time to talk to Lois Lane when he could be, you know, helping tsunami victims or, you know, preventing a dam breaking in Taunton, you know? So there's always some good you can be doing, which can make you crazy, too. There's a condition I call altruistic panic, where you feel like you got to do something for somebody somewhere. Anyway. But anyway, so, you know, if life has no meaning and has only the meaning you bring to it, then we're free to bring, you know, tremendous, you know, rich meaning to our lives by the service we can bring to others, by the importance of what we can say, you know, it's a positive thing.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Clayburgh Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. Generous support is also provided by the City of Austin Cultural Arts Division, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, the Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan, and the show is produced and edited by myself, Brian Ramos. I do the music for the show as well. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Katie Stewart, editing help from Jamal Knox. Production assistance from KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and conference in October. Until next time, I'm Brian Ramos, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.